Now, there seems, by implication, there seems to be a cash issue from the years 1995 to 1997. How did you capitalize your business?
I think it was like $36,000. Essentially, my wife Sierra worked, and we knew that we could at least cover our personal expenses. We bought our initial set of tools and stuff like that, and that was it. That was the only capital investment we had for many years. I mean, we really never, we just lived very, you know, low on the food chain, and we conserved what we had, and we, you know, really put everything we had into, you know, breathing life into and growing a sustainable business. And really, it was
a classic on,
just sort of like growing a garden. You know, you till the soil, you put some fertilizer in it, you get the seed, you plant the seed, and you let it grow. Now, if you start picking that plant too soon, you know, it's never going to become a healthy plant. You know, you have to have patience. You have to allow this organism, you know, this organization to grow to a place where it can start to become productive. And if you have the ability to do that, you know, I think a lot of people just get too impatient. What they do is they just have all this ego. It's like, my business has to look like this. It has to be like this. It's got to provide this for me. And if it doesn't, then I'm a failure. So I'm going to just make sure that it is what it is. And even if it's not, I'm going to do it anyway. And that's what creates businesses to fail in their first.
Your garden analysis is excellent because it took me 2 years of manure, plowing in, et cetera, to create a really productive garden. And then, you know, 8 years down the road, I didn't have to add in anything. It was a self-sustaining garden that required no fertilizer to produce massive quantities. And people today don't really have that kind of understanding of patience. When problems arose, so, I mean, starting in 1997, you started to receive a cash flow, right?
Yeah, I mean,
that's a yes or no. That's a yes or no.
When I started really drawing a salary, and,
right?
You know,
yeah, you should.
It wasn't much of one, but you know, we were paying our employees. The company was running pretty much flat.
Your employees were there on a volunteer basis prior to that?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, we were paying our people. I mean, from the very beginning, of course we have to pay people, but you know, I think.
They took less because they were also bought into your vision.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a mission thing. And, you know, we would use, especially in the beginning, it was very temporary employees and
right.
Things like that. But it, you know, it grew fairly quickly to be where we were able to have, I think we had about, you know, 4 or 5 people fairly quickly that we were able to sustain. That included myself.
When problems arose, how does your management team or you resolve them?
Well, we operate under a fairly democratic organizing principle. I mean, I kind of hold the right, at least at this point, to kind of be... you know, I can put in a veto, but I try not to. I mean, we really, it's a collective decision-making process, so we really, you know, I've always felt like the key is to bring a lot of different ideas to the table and allow these ideas to coalesce and synergize into a good decision. There's some perspectives that I've always had that nobody else has, at least up until now. So from a financial standpoint, you know, I kind of held some very strong grips on what I was willing to risk or, you know, I've always felt like the best bookkeeper I had for a long time was just my DNA. Like I could tell when that balance was off between what was coming in and could feel it in my bones.
I know that too. I couldn't take algebra well, but I can read. I can intuitively understand my own balance sheet and cash flow.
And you just got it. And it's sort of like, okay, all right, that's really key that I knew that, and so I kind of knew. And you know, knowing, working through intuition, so you know, understanding what might be coming down the pike was really key. Now, the first big hit that happened to the company really was in 2001. It was the first recession. I guess it was, you know, it was just right after Y2K, so we went through a really big growth period.
Well, you voted for them.
And of course, you know, the bottom dropped out of our market, and, you know, because Y2K didn't happen, so all of a sudden people stopped doing solar, and then that first recession hit. Well, you know, this was the first time I really got to learn what businesses do, and the cash flow crunch came down on us. I mean, you know, it was a very difficult period, and, you know, Sierra and I really thought about this a lot, and what we chose to do was essentially to capitalize the organization to maintain the people of the organization, because we've always felt that the people that we have are the true value that we have as an organization.
The I'm going to skip the next question because you've already answered how experiences during your career influence the way you run your own company. I think you have. And now when somebody joins your company, by the way, one thing that you're democratic or mostly democratic means of operations allow for ownership of the employees into the company.
And, you know, I wanted to talk about that structure still because, you know, what we really try and do and what we have, the sort of the template, you know, the thing that we have to break with most people that come to the organization is that militaristic model. People are so programmed for a militaristic model, they don't know what to do when what we tell people in the interview and as we're hiring is that what we want to do is organize through a sense of accountability to each other. That I'm accountable to you, you're accountable to me. We want to operate through accountability and not through authority. And by if we truly become accountable to each other as a team, then that process is a level playing field rather than this hierarchical playing field. That's going to lend itself to more synergy, more creativity, more fulfillment, and more personal responsibility, because ultimately the more personal responsibility anyone takes for themselves, the more fulfilled they're going to be. It's this, you know, it's kind of one of these conundrums of life where people want to outsource their responsibility so somehow they can be, you know, that's why we have the, you know, the people who are suing everybody else. You know, nobody wants to take responsibility for themselves.
Well, I'm going to sue you
for... Therefore, they can never really, truly be fulfilled because it's all a question of somebody else, you know, they're victims. And so we don't want to create a victim mentality here. We want to create an empowerment, a source, an essential source of empowerment for people to plug into. And this idea of organizing through accountability transforms the way that we relate to each other within the organization and now gives people this ability to truly become empowered in what they're doing.
Kind of like the joining the two ends of the bell curve, a capitalist version of power to the people.
Absolutely.
When someone joins your company, how do you orient them as a member of your team?
Well, you know, we do that. I mean, we definitely talk to them about that, and it's a daily process, you know. I mean, there's enough, at this point, there's enough of a group environment where we're very open. You know, we don't have a lot of cubby holes. We don't have a lot of, you know, individual offices. We're very much out there. People hear almost everything that everybody says. So from a communication standpoint, there's a lot of openness. Again, you know, the more we can share ourselves and share what's going on, and then say, well, you know, that's, you can see that this is happening, but it's just not your responsibility right now to be engaged in this part of the organization. You need to keep focusing over here while we're doing this. It's sort of like, the hand is the hand. It's all part of the human body. And the minute the hand starts to try and do what the foot does, it's not good. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work. So it's like,
wait, what each other's doing. What happens when I put my foot in my mouth?
It doesn't work too well, does it?
No, it teaches me how to tie my shoes while it's in my mouth.
So, I mean, the point is that, you know, it's not that we want to have separateness and all of these, you know, fiefdoms within and try and balancing the fiefdoms of the organization. We want to have something that's integrated, that's working together.
But you do tell them.
Information flow and communicating and creating this common conversation integrates all the different elements of the organization into a working whole.
Which is exactly what we did in Cool Fruits. It was all open offices, and everyone was listening to everybody else, and therefore you didn't require these formal meetings to tell everybody else what everybody else was doing. However, you do tell them that this is what we need for you to focus on.
Absolutely.
And then augment that.
Now, be the hand.
Let me see if I can...
Be the hand. We've got other people that are being the foot. We've got other people that are being the central nervous system. You know, we've got the metabolics. You know, we've got the accounting. You know, they're doing the... making sure the energy's flowing. You know, making sure that we have the... the resources we need. So, you know, and that's respect. So now, you know, you have this idea of accountability, and then you have this idea of respecting the different elements and the different parts of the company and what they bring to the table.
And there's an
their experience is, and making sure that you have good communication between those elements is really key.
Sounds like you have meetings every day because people are listening to everybody else, which actually is a more efficient system of having meetings. How do you? Well, it's obvious that you've answered this question, but not in specific of how you motivate. You've talked about passion and their mission statement and stuff like that. But how do you reward? Is there any other ways of rewarding people except through the intrinsic, wonderful, march towards doing the right thing and making money by doing so? Is there any other methods you use to reward people?
That is a really, really good question. Okay, so and this is something we're working on here right now, because it's interesting. You know, we really are a firm believer that the more we make sure that, especially within our business, which is very complicated, there's long-term projects, there's long-term responsibilities, there's, you know, it's not like, oh, I sold this widget, I made this money, and it's done, I got it, no problem. You know, we could sell a project and then have warranty issues a year down the line that take away some of the profit, you know. So, you know, there's definitely... things that it's not a cut and dry simple business. And so what we've done initially was to create a very strong profit sharing program that really said to people, listen, let's all join together, let's all row this boat together, and as we row the boat, if we're successful as a team, then we're going to be successful as a company, and then everybody's going to share in that prosperity. If we're not successful as a company, then we're not, and we'll not share together as well. Okay? People are not, again, programmed to think that way. It's very, you know, we're in this, immediate gratification type society. And so, you know, managing the expectations of people has been a very big challenge for us, because you know, the idea of sustainability runs really deep here. And so, you know, when you look around and you've got all these companies, people might be making all this money, but, you know, most of these companies aren't sustainable. So it's sort of like, well, if you really do believe in sustainability, you know, how do we have to manage our expectations on what we expect out of the world, out of a job, out of this? So are there other levels and layers of satisfaction and fulfillment that, you know, can almost be priceless? And can we organize and focus people on the collective as the vehicle for prosperity as opposed to just the individual? So, you know, there's a lot of these incentive programs which is like, well, I have control over myself. I go out, I do this, and I get incentivized to do a good job here.
Right.
Well, the shift is let's incentivize the group. So it's like, well, I can't just do this alone. I've got to make sure I'm working well with the team to make this happen. Okay, so the idea of creating a strong profit sharing was to really focus people's efforts on the teamwork approach to creating prosperity rather than just an individual approach.
Which is really brilliant because it makes individuals managers of other people and making sure that because they're reliant on the other people to perform in order for them to get rewarded. Kind of related to my, but you've taken it to another step. My Avis commercial where I said, when you own your own business, you sweat every detail. Nobody works like an owner. Nobody cares like an owner. When I started this business, I made my employees owners. And you've taken that to a new step in specificity. So it's really cool. How do you select people to join your company, which is probably one of my, as an entrepreneur, one of my biggest weaknesses? Because I tend to see people for what they can be, and what they, rather than what they are and what they are. And so I give them too much credit right off the bat. So that's my handicap in hiring people. How do you select people to join your company?
Well, you know, there's usually a committee, so there's usually more than one, you know, there's usually at least three people.
Are you guys communists?
What's that?
Are you guys communists? Just kidding. Go ahead.
So there's usually three people that are part of the interview process. You know, some of it is intuitive. Some of it is, you know, is a feel, so I can get a feel. I mean, some of it's cultural, so we need to make sure that people are culturally going to make this fit in this sort of new paradigm. Although I have really embraced a lot of diversity, so, you know, I'm one that sees that there's lots of different pieces to the puzzle, and we're not here to create, you know, a monoculture. And so, you know, each hire is a little bit different in terms of what I see as a potential. I, too, have had the problem of seeing people's potential and but always in those instances, I've really, you know, those people, even though they don't necessarily stay long-term, they've always provided some insight or some perspective that we needed, you know, to kind of grasp and get, you know, especially the old school stuff. Like, there's been a few people that we've had here that were totally old school. And I was like, wow, okay, well, that's not going to fit. But, man, some of these concepts and some of these things that they brought, it's, like, really good to have in our quiver, you know. It's like, okay, well, that way you can pick and choose. You don't have to completely reinvent the wheel every time.
I gotta tell you right there, what I'm having a problem with in my education is this lack of old school, and old school includes Aristotle, Plato, Piaget, Freud, metaphysicians. I mean, you're talking about people who had time to think without the overload of the information technology coming in and keep it as a distraction. And so, you go back to these farmers who are 75 years old, and I gotta tell you something, there's knowledge that we're losing from the old school, so-called old school. Now, clearly, it's my belief that we have to go back to the future, okay? We've gotten too far ahead of ourselves and become addicted to the cutting edge. When you combine the cutting edge with old school, then you get the best of both worlds. But I'm not interviewing me. I'm interviewing you, but you hit on a very particularly, for instance, I'm having trouble with this thing called Blackboard, which is a means of teaching and communicating. The thing needs chalk, okay? The thing needs chalk, it's pathetic. But at any rate, let's go to how are things going in your company in general right now? Are you hiring, downsizing, staying where you are? In terms of your company's workforce, are sales up, down, or flat?
I think this year is going to be our best year ever. So, of course, the first half of the year didn't feel like that. Was very austere.
Why do you think that is?
We really hired a whole bunch of people. We have more people working for us now than we ever have. I think we're at like 35
wow.
people right now. Quite a few of those are temp workers and things like that. So, but we have a lot of work to do.
I call those temp workers.
And so this comes to the second notion of sustainability, which I want to talk about in two ways. Businesses, people tend to look at businesses needing to eternally grow. And, there's very few things on the planet that just grow forever, there's really hardly any, and really there's none that grow forever. So, when you start to understand and take away the egoic notions of what success means, and you realize that success can, really be transformed into in its core basic of like, okay, I want to have a really great place to work where I like to be there, I like to work, it's a great environment, and it satisfies my financial needs. Okay, so that to me is the success if you can do that. So we've looked at this notion of like being able to inhale and exhale. Like a tree that grows up to a certain place and then, something comes up and it loses a big branch and, sheds itself. It does it willingly. It doesn't mean it's a bad tree, a good tree. It's just doing what it needs to do in order to be sustainable and to survive. It's devoid of judgment. And I think people make a mistake of thinking of placing these judgments on their businesses that it has to perform a certain way rather than going that, we need the business to respond to the environment rather than the business trying to create an environment so it can do what it wants to.
You've got built-in business flexibility.
And so what we're doing is, right now is like the inhale, so we're doing it as we're hiring temporary workers.
Where's the business coming from? Where's the new business coming from? Where's the increase? Where's the increase in business coming from? How is it happening?
It's coming from all over, but there's been some grants that folks have gotten, so there's been some bid work that's out there, and we're also at the end of a cycle. Solar panels are cheaper than they've ever been, so it's a really there's kind of a perfect storm right now for people if they were interested to do it and to do it for less money than they've ever been able to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a function of A, there's been a lot of this grant money that came down from the Recovery Act that's finally hitting the ground now, 3 years later. So there's several projects that we're doing that are so associated with these grants.
Do you think you can make up for the loss that we've achieved through Solyndra? This is
the Solyndra thing. I mean, people are making a big deal of it.
No, don't answer that question. Don't answer that question. Don't answer that question.
All the time. I mean,
don't answer that question. The model of Solyndra is not that investment shouldn't be made in advanced renewable technology and production. It's that who decides who gets the grant and how. But you've stated that there is capital in the industry to spend, and therefore there you are, having established yourself as a performer and are able to take advantage of this. Can you describe a typical day of either Sundance and or Dave Hollister?
We're a service organization, so I mean, we have, at this point, I think we have about 6 crews at any one time that are out doing work in the all over, you know, North Carolina. We have crews that are working in Raleigh. We have that are working in South Carolina. We have crews that are working, all over Western North Carolina. So you know, it's really a logistical and supply chain issue, and a management issue on some levels. And then there's just the physical, technical side of things, which is, you know, okay, having the people that are trained, that know the technology, and can install these systems in a high quality way.
To summarize, it's management of existing business and logistical, and making sure the logistics don't are efficient, so they're not to exceed your gross your net margins. And
my role at this point is really as a guide, is to sort of oversee and look and say, okay, there's potentially a problem here. You know, I work with cash flow a lot because that's a big issue for us. So, you know, managing the cash flow has been a huge part of my job over the,
wouldn't you agree that a good CEO first looks at the potential fires and deals with them first before he moves on to other things?
Yeah, I mean, I try and as best I can get everybody to deal with those, you know, and empower themselves to, you know, be able to find solutions. I mean,
but you're still watching.
So I don't want to create dependency here, you know, and that's probably one of the hardest things as an entrepreneur, is to really let go enough to trust people to really give them the ability to, you know.
So you've spread the firefighting out.
Oh, yeah.
That's terrific.
I mean, you have to. You've just got to. Otherwise, you know, I mean, there was a time when, I mean, this was the last place I wanted to be.
Right.
Because all I dealt with was all the problems.
Right. Right.
That was because I wasn't empowering people to really stand in their roles and really own all the responsibilities, you know, because in the beginning, you know, all that's coming to you.
Letting go is...
Right, oh, yeah, and so I did this meditation for a long time where I just, you know, saw the company as outside of myself, you know. I just put it over my head, you know. I've really meditated on... You know, that birthing process was the most painful process I've ever been through in my life. Of really just, you know, I mean, sometimes it had to be ripped out of me. So, you know, it wasn't always a conscious, willingly conscious thing. Sometimes I had the right people that had the right amount of force to just take it from me.
Well,
put it out of my hands, and that was great. That's a good thing.
And
I see that now when it's happening, you don't necessarily see it. So one of the most valuable lessons that anybody can be given as, you know, in that entrepreneurial role is that notion that, you know, in the beginning it is you. You invest a whole lot of your identity, at least I did, a whole lot of who I was emotionally. You know, you're putting a ton of energy into this thing, and at some point, you know, it's got to come through the birth canal and come out and live on its own. You know, it has to. Otherwise, you know, you become the limiting factor.
Mm.
You know, we individually start to limit the growth and the ability of what that organization can do.
That's a phenomenal voyage through meditation towards letting go control. The form of meditation you took was what?
I would actually sit and meditate and put the company like 3 feet above my head. I would just see it as outside of myself. And then I could start to relate to it as a separate entity as opposed to just something that was happening inside of me.
Where did you come up with this?
actually, I came up with it through a spiritual master who gave me this idea. And I've been very blessed to have come in contact with numerous people like that. And, you know, on various levels. So, you know, that's the other thing of manifesting is that, you know, as we've needed it, we've had some very remarkable people that have come and participated at various times that helped the organization through some difficult times.
They seem, it seems to be that your company is actually being run and survived from a higher power.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about it. At this point, I know that the company has its own life force and that it's manifesting as a function of all of the people here and all of our intention. And in fact, together, we consciously bring those intentions to the table and say, okay, this is what we're doing. This is what we want to do. We do that in our management team, and we do it once a month with collectively as the whole organization projection so that we can, you know, really align all of our energies to manifest the type of company and the type of opportunities that are going to serve us and really take care of us.
That's extremely profound, and probably why one of the reasons why I was interviewing you. I'm a little bit taken aback by that, so I get a little recover because of how impressive it was. So I'm just going to move on to my next question, and read it because I'm still back with what you just said, and, any advice quickly in one or two sentences you'd give to someone who's considering a career in alternate energy?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's about...
Two sentences.
Sundance is a little different, but, you know, the thing is like with any navigation that you have as an individual... You really have to understand what it is that you're willing to give and what it is that you're willing to accept as your reward. You know, when people come here, that's one of the things we do. We actually say, when you talked about compensation, you know, we talk about, well, what is it that you really need? Not, you know, what do you want, but what is it that you need? You know, what are your immediate needs, and do they line up with, you know, the particular role or job that's being offered? You know, because we all can, you know, if we all start going out of this just basic selfish desires, then, you know, our needs can be pretty overwhelming, and I don't think they really ever become satisfied. Again, that comes back to what is the sense of success. You know, if success is growing the biggest company, well, there's always another bigger company. How could you ever be successful?
Mm.
If it's, you know, putting in the biggest solar system, well, there's always going to be a bigger one. You're never going to have real success. It's always going to be You know, you need success to be something that is a steady state. It's something that goes deeper and more fulfilling than these egoic notions that we typically have used to create success in the world or to identify what success looks like.
How do you keep how do you keep up with current events in your industry? I mean, you know, trade shows, publications.
Well, I'll just finish that. I just think that, you know, people, it can be a lot of hard work if you're coming in as a technician. You know, we deal with, again, managing those expectations. We have a lot of, you know, upper middle class, highly educated white males that come out of college going into renewable energy, and they hit the ground and running in the crews, and it's like, ugh, God, this is hard work. You know, there's managing expectations and understanding that, you know, we're doing things for a variety of reasons. And so that's been a tough one for a lot of folks coming out of college, at least in our area.
Well, I think
a lot of hard work. Awesome. It is diverse. It is growing. There's a lot of potential. So, you know, look to the long term. You know, be willing to put in some sweat equity to get down the road a little bit. That would be my recommendation for people.
Okay. Just